I was riding in my car, screaming at the night, screaming at the dark, screaming at fright. I wasn't doing nothing, just driving about, screaming at the dark, letting it out. That's all I was doing, just letting it out. Well, along comes a motorcycle, very much to my surprise. I said, "Officer, was I speeding?" I couldn't see his eyes. He said, "No, you weren't speeding." And he felt where his gun was hung. He said, "Lady, you were screaming at the top of your lung. And you were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming in your car in the 20-mile zone. You were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming. You were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming in your car in the 20-mile zone. You were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming." I said, "I'll roll up all my windows, don't want to disturb the peace. I'm just a creature who's looking for a little release." I said, "What's so wrong with screaming? Don't you do it at your games? When the quarterback breaks an elbow, when the boxer beats some names. But you were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming in your car in the 20-mile zone. You were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming. You were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming in your car in the 20-mile zone. You were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming." I said, "Animals roar when they feel like." I said, "Why can't we do that too? Instead of screaming, bonsai baby, in the war, in the human zoo." He said, "I got to take you in now. Follow me right behind. And let's have no more screaming, like you're out of your mind." So he climbed aboard his cycle, and his red-eyed headlight beamed, and his motor started spinning, and his siren screamed. He was doing it alone, he was doing it alone. He was screaming on his bike in the 20-mile zone. He was doing it alone, he was doing it alone. He was screaming. I was doing it alone.
All right, and that's a wonderful tune by Dore Previn called 20 Mile Zone, which is definitely appropriate for the theme of today, which is about a film, Dialogues with Mad Women, which is playing this evening, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Montville United Methodist Church. That's a 232 Southeast 80th Avenue here in Portland, as part of a Rethinking Psychiatry's monthly event series. And if you're not able to stay tuned for the rest of the program, I recommend coming and checking that out. If you didn't see it in 1994 when it was released, we are revisiting a film that has held up remarkably well. And to talk about it, we actually have the director on the line from San Francisco. Good morning, Allie Light.
Very nice to talk to you this morning.
Yeah.
Although it's early.
Yeah, well, that's a morning talk radio here on KBOO. And we have a lot of regular listeners who, well, a lot of people actually are up listening to Democracy Now! At 7, and then stay tuned, continue to listen to this program. And I just watched your film in its entirety yesterday. It was a very powerful experience, I must say. Very, very intense, very honest, at times brutally honest and truthful, and a real window, you know, into the lives and experiences of people that our society often still, you know, after all this time and a lot of struggle and and anyway, and people still tend to be, stories still tend to be shut out. So it's very valuable, I think. So one thing that I just want to ask you right off the bat, as we get into this, and of course the number to call in to share, join in this conversation is 503-231-8187. But give us a few minutes to kind of get rolling here. So, you know, it's been, 24 years, right? 24 years since that film came out. And I've sort of been reading some old reviews and just things that kind of came out at the time. And it created something of a stir at the time. I don't know how long that lasted, how much it really, you know, kind of impacted the collective psyche. But talk a little bit about, you know, the times that this movie came out, Dialogues with Mad Women. The reaction at the time.
You want me to talk about
it? Yeah.
Well, you know, it's been, as you said, about 25 years or so since it came out, but it's been a lifetime since I had the experience. So that was way, way back. That was when I was 28 years old, and now I'm an old woman. And I'm a different person in a lot of, in many ways, in the ways that one normally becomes a different person as we age, but also because of the experiences that I had and the results of the experiences.
Let me just say that you're one of the seven women actually featured.
Yes.
You filmed yourself. You kind of interviewed yourself, as it were. And I guess maybe the first thing to say is what this film is all about.
Okay. It began as a film about my own experience committing myself to a mental hospital. I got very depressed when I was in my mid to late 20s, and I thought that this is the way to make me well. I would never do it again. But in the 50s, there was a different kind of woman. There was a woman who, I got married right away out of high school, and I felt isolated, and women didn't share their experiences like we do now. And so the only thing I could think of doing to save myself was to commit myself to a mental hospital. So that happened around the time that of the assassination of Kennedy, and I start my story by saying, people always ask you this question, where were you? And I was always afraid to say, because I was in a mental hospital. And that's a part of my story. But from there, you know, I got out of the hospital. It was a 3 months day ward experience, so that I was allowed to go home on weekends if I would do certain things that the psychiatrist asked me to do, such as mop all the floors in my house or cook certain foods for my family, so that I could prove that I was trying very hard to be the housewife and the mother that I had set myself up as. So that's how it got started. And then I became a feminist. I lost my first husband several years after that. He died of cancer. I was left a widow with three small children. And I became a feminist. I went back to school. I taught women's studies for many years, and that's really how the film began. I would tell my students my story, what happened to me, my experience in the mental hospital, and lo and behold, they would tell me their stories, or the stories of their mothers, or the stories of their grandmothers. So eventually it seemed to me that the best thing to do would be to make a film. And since I was starting with my experience, of course I was in the film, but I was also behind the camera, and that's a very tricky thing to do. And I can tell you very, very well that the hottest spot is in front of the camera. But I set out to prove to the women, some of them were my students, some were other women that I met who had experiences in the mental health system, and I set out to prove to them that I would make myself as vulnerable as they would. And so I did the first interview with myself.
And that seemed to be to me, this is kind of a projection, but it seemed to be reflected in in how open they seem to be. You definitely did seem to create an environment in which they felt very comfortable talking about what happened to them.
Sure, I said I would never ask them to say or do anything that I wasn't willing to do myself.
Mm-hmm. And so we're going to kind of jump forward and back a little bit, but you know what? I guess a lot of things interest me, and I, as I've said on previous programs, I had my own brief bout with mental emotional instability. A brief manic episode a number of years ago, which was an extremely frightening experience. These kind of experiences are always frightening, whatever their end result are, and give us a real kind of insight into what other people are going through. Because as I said at the outset, I think there's still I think it's worn off to a large degree, and you might want to comment on that, the stigma attached to it, but it's certainly still there. I had a guest on who was talking about who had had a serious electroshock that had a very damaging effect on his life, and he only really came out just relatively after he retired to talk about those experiences. Just as you said, you didn't want to say where you were when Kennedy was assassinated. It was until after he retired that he felt he could actually talk about it, because he felt it would have, a negative impact on his career, his friendships, relationships, et cetera.
Well, one of the things that helped all of us come out is the fact that we hooked up together with one another and began groups of people who had experiences with the mental health system and began to protest and, walk in front of the National Psychiatric Association meetings and things like that. Once people began to get together and discuss what had happened to them, it gives anyone a lot of courage. And I think that's how we got started. There's some film sequences. There's a short sequence of that kind of a protest in front of in my film, in front of a psychiatric convention.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, I think that, we hold hands and we stand up and we speak louder because we're all speaking.
And, of course, that's the context in which this film is being shown, one of the heirs to that movement, which really, largely came out of the 1960s, the psychiatric survivors movement, or I guess some people called it the Mad Liberation Movement at one time. Mm-hmm. There was actually a Mad Lib group here in Portland back in the day. Maybe there's some people listening who actually were part of that or know about that. So Rethinking Psychiatry is a group that does those same kind of things. We actually protested at a local Kaiser Sunnyside clinic that still does electroshock. Of course, that's a very still somewhat controversial subject. Some people feel it does help them. Many people feel that it's damaged them. But it's one of the subjects that Rethinking Psychiatry explores, among many others, including, as I said, showing your film Dialogues with Mad Women. That's tonight. So, yeah, talk. My initial question, which was perhaps needed a little background for you to be able to answer more fully, but the reception that this film got, and I'm thinking amongst various, there's some really interesting moments in the film where, this is really the context of his time. I think things have really changed, but there's a woman who said that she couldn't come out as a lesbian, as a feminist, because the feminists at that time, didn't want to, involve lesbians, and she didn't feel like she could come out as a mental health survivor to the lesbian movement because they didn't want to hear it. I don't know if I'm sure that, as I said, those things have changed. Talk a little bit about the reception in various communities, not just like the film critics and the audiences, but talk about its like general reception. What kind of impact you feel it had, politically even?
Well, that's a question that that requires a lot of different answers, I uh-huh. think. I thought I was making a film, a little kind of guerrilla type film for women like myself, women of the 50s and early 60s who really were stuck and isolated at home. Most of us with children already, most of us young, most of us missing out on a lot of things that were going on. And I didn't really think that anyone else would be so interested. But the film actually just, it took off with it. A huge bang. I mean, I think that I found that everyone was interested, no matter where the film was shown, whether it was Berlin at the big Berlin Film Festival, Sundance, any of those places, all showed the film. And whether it was shown there or it was shown in the local theater, people would stand up and right away say, "This happened to me. This is," and begin to tell their stories. I mean, it's very interesting in the film festival when people want to tell you their stories, are more interested in telling you their stories than talking about what they just saw on the screen. And I felt that was a really successful way to present the subject, is to mm-hmm. engage people in their own experiences immediately. And that's what happened. The film is old, and it's been shown everywhere. It's now making its way around Italy. I had a call about 3 years ago from some young women in Italy who said, "Can we translate the film?" And I said, "Sure." And, you know, they did that. It took them a long time. And I just gave them the rights to the film. I mean, they can have the film in Italy and do what they want with it, because I'm grateful that they did that. They made the film even more visible by what they did, and so the film is making its way around Italy now, and, you know, 25, almost 30 years later. There are lots of things that are no longer relevant, I think, in the film, but not as many as you think. I mean, I was thinking when I was listening to the music that you played, I was thinking about Stelazine, and one day, I don't even know if people use that anymore, but I was drenched in it. And trying to get to my mother's house by car after, you know, having so many doses of Stelazine. And I couldn't stop at the stop signs. There was something in my foot that wouldn't take itself off of the accelerator. So the film, the music that you played in the beginning, you know, and my experience of trying to drive and trying to put on a brake, it just came together in a wonderful feeling of that, you know, things are not so different in many ways. So
Stelazine, is that a relative of Thorazine?
I know, because Thorazine makes you feel like a zombie. Uh-huh. I wrote a piece called Thorazine Shuffle for a book on mental health, and Stelazine, it does the opposite. You can't stop. You feel like there's no way that you just can't keep plunging forward forever, and there are no brakes. So thank you for that song.
Uh-huh. So yeah, it's interesting, you know, because Thorazine is mentioned repeatedly in the film. It was obviously massively used at the time. Yeah. I don't know if it's used at all anymore or how much.
I would like to know that,
yeah,
actually.
But I know there's a whole new class. The pharmaceutical industry has not been idle in the years since. They've invented innumerable sorts, all sorts of classes, one of which actually, ironically for myself, actually kind of saved my ass, kind of put me to sleep when I was having this manic episode due to insomnia. But anyway, don't get into my story too much, but I just say ironic because I've never used, I don't even like take, you know, painkillers hardly at all. I've been very lucky in my life to have otherwise very good health, but I've, you know, philosophically, you know, sort of on principle, I try to refrain from taking things. So it was galling to me that I did. And I think that's probably true for a lot of people, whether or not they, you know, they had such strong beliefs about, you know, taking such things. But I think, mm-hmm. you know, anybody, if they just do things to you that you know are not being good for you at the time.
Yeah. Did you have the right to refuse?
No. I needed to get to sleep. Yeah. I was willing to do whatever this particular doctor said, because I I literally thought I was near a breaking point, that, and I think I possibly was. And, you know, I think, you know, and that's why I have such, you know, a greater sensitivity towards others. Cause I really do think there, but for the grace of me, go, you know, other people that I see who've been so mm-hmm. damaged by whatever trauma, and, you know, and then the trauma, people are often re-traumatized by the substances that they're taking to supposedly deal with the original trauma. And, you know, and I, as a someone who was actually helped by one of these incredibly powerful substances, you know, I don't know, I would have preferred, I think I could have been helped in other ways, but, you know, we live in a society that isn't structured so that it actually has situations and places where people in severe distress can actually be really helped. It's a very gruesome situation, but anyway, that, you know, I could go off on that. But the point, I guess, is that yeah, I feel like I gain greater empathy for people who are suffering distress, and so that's, you know, that's one reason why I'm doing the show. I guess I was going to say at the outset that I've sort of decided to at least for the time being devote the first Wednesday of each month to themes of I had this kind of written out. Let me just say it: mental and emotional health and stability, the mental health system, and its many abuses. But also, you know, sometimes it actually is effective or helps people. Different modalities and approaches to healing, issues of historical trauma and abuse, different understandings of the causes of mental and emotional health distress and dysfunction, et cetera, et cetera. So this is kind of an inaugural show in a way, launching this first Wednesday devoted to these issues. And I'm glad to have you on because I didn't know about your film. It's the first time I've seen it. It does seem to be, you know, somewhat of an important film historically. I was also going to ask you about, maybe we can talk later about other treatment of these issues in film, if you're familiar with that. But it looks like we already have a caller, and I would like to invite people to call in at 503-231-8187 to talk with Allie Light, again, the director of Dialogues with Mad Women. And this is one of many, many, many films that she has made and made with her husband, her partner, Irving Saraf, who passed away a number of years ago. She's actually won an Academy Award and an Emmy Award. Actually, for this film, you won an Emmy. But let's go to our first caller, Jeremy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I love playing psychopharmacologist. I sort of came by my knowledge experientially. I think you had a paradoxical reaction to Stelazine. It's not as sedating as Thorazine, but it certainly doesn't hype you up. It's still, they're both classified as what are called phenothiazines. They're considered major tranquilizers. And when I was twitching on the floor, unable to talk from the massive dose of Thorazine they gave me, this went on for several days until I was able to finally ask them to recite what other drugs I might be able to, that the, you know, 23-year-old psychiatric resident could substitute for Thorazine, and Stelazine was one of them. I'd taken it once recreationally, thinking it was an upper, it's a downer, and my symptoms were a little less terrible. But they're both made by SmithKline French, and they're both pretty horrible. I'm now going to read, if I can, from Dr. Caligari's Psychiatric Drugs, a famous publication in the late 70s, and this is an ad from some psychiatrist magazine. Warning, meno patients are notorious drug evaders. Many meno patients cheek or hide their tablets and then dispose of them. Unless this practice is stopped, they deprive themselves of opportunities for improvement or remission, deceive their doctors into thinking that their drugs have failed, and impose a needless drain on the hospital's finances. When drug evaders jeopardize the effectiveness of your treatment program, specify liquid concentrate. And it's Stelazine, Thorazine, Comazine. Anyway,
drug evaders, son. That's what we were. drug evaders.
Yeah. I was eventually caught taking my meds, and then, you know, large people showed up. One of them bearing a needle and said,
That was my experience too. I had the same reaction you did to Thorazine, and you know, it took 2 days to wake me up once, and I had been begging not to have it because I said it. I go unconscious. Please don't. And the doctor, you know, they don't listen. They didn't listen. But, you know, drugs at my time were forced on us. If we didn't take them, we got the needle.
This happened to me in 1970, so it was pretty much the same. There's a landmark case in California in the 70s, which began to extend at least liberty rights to psychiatric inmates, but the right to refuse drugs, you know, informed consent, that's still very limited.
It is limited. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'm from another period, you know, in the mental health system. Once you step into it, you can't step out.
The sad thing from what I've been able to glean about the current situation is that it's more the same than it's different. I mean, what's changed is the finances. They can't, you know, nurses are paid reasonable salaries now. A hospital day is way up, you know, from the 50s when they were warehousing, you know, many more people. We had a much smaller country, and we had, I don't know, 3-4 times as many people in mental hospitals as we do now. They're not willing to pay for that. That's the reason the hospitals, you know, got closed down, is because they were too expensive. But once you get your sad butt incarcerated, it's more the same than it's different. You know, you theoretically have the right to refuse drugs, but they can violate that. They can override you. You know, they can take you to court and you know, a psychiatrist is expert testimony and you're not. And unless you have a lawyer, it's pretty hard to avoid getting forcibly medicated, which, you know, legally is assault and battery, but so what?
Yeah, so some things stay the same.
Okay, well...
Yeah.
Jeremy,
anyway,
thank you.
I'm sorry I'm going to miss your movie, but I have to go to Joanne Hardesty's inauguration downtown. And I'm wanted to announce that I believe it's 6 to 8 p.m. there should be a party with really good food, and I'm hoping your movie's available online in some capacity, or do I have to order it?
I have heard of it.
And I would love to see it.
Yeah, it isn't yet, but it has a distributor. Women make movies in New York, but it should be. They should do that with it. Well, if you come to San Francisco, look me up, and I will show you the movie at my house.
I'll take you up on that. I'm in the Bay Area once a year, and I'll put you on my calendar. Thank you so much.
Okay, Jeremy, thank you.
Thanks for calling, Jeremy. And Women Make Movies. They have a website. You can go there, and we do have a copy here in Portland, and it will be shown again tonight, 7 p.m. at the Montville United Methodist Church, 232 Southeast 80th Avenue. There's usually a fair amount of discussion afterwards. I think there won't be a whole lot of time for that, but you can meet the folks with Rethinking Psychiatry. It's one group in town. I'll be featuring them, and there's other groups in town, and maybe you belong to one of them. You might want to call us up at 503-231-8187. Looks like we've got someone who calls themselves Good Soul. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. We're ramping up for more potty. I know. Very
Are you on speakerphone? We can't hear you at all.
Yes, I can't hear.
Can you hear me?
You're on. You must be on speakerphone. We can't hear you at all.
Oh, well.
You're echoing.
Well, we're going to have to get back to you on that. You maybe want to call us back. People try to make sure your phone quality is as good as it can be. 503-231-8187. We're starting to talk about sort of the political effect, or the, you know, the impact it made. So it was shown on PBS, right, as part of their Point of View series, is that right?
Yes, it was.
So that had a very wide release, and then it showed in movie theaters as well?
Yes, it was shown in theaters and many, many festivals. It was a real festival, loved by the festivals.
Uh-huh.
So most colleges and universities have purchased it at one time or another.
I read a interview that was done... I forget the source, but anyways, a very extensive interview, and it went over a lot of the same questions I wanted to ask you, which, like, did you stay in touch with any of the women, and I guess this was soon after, so I guess I'll ask you that question again. I know one of them tragically was murdered during the editing process, which I can't even imagine. She was such a, God, what a, I mean, all the women in the film were just seven of them that you interviewed in this, well, including yourself, were just amazing people, just their stories and their, and just their, the life force and the, you know, their sense of self throughout, you know, that experience and afterwards. But it must have been just really terrible setback to you personally and the film, having Karen Wong murdered like that.
First, Paul, my intention, the very thing that I wanted to show right away was that women are articulate. We can tell our own stories. We don't need someone to interpret for us. We don't need a doctor to explain to us, to the community or the world, what's wrong with us. We know. And that was the most important thing to me, to find women who could really tell their own stories and were articulate. And there are many of us, and every woman in this, in the film is able to really describe what her life, what she was going through, what her life was like, and what the mental health system did to her. So that was really the main reason for making the movie. The second thing about Karen Wong is, yes, it was very startling because it had nothing to do with her mental health or anything. I mean, she came home from the laundromat one night with her clothes all folded in a basket, and there was someone in her house. And he murdered her, raped her, and it took 20 more than, well, he was captured finally about 3 years ago. He's been in prison. I went to his trial. He was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison, and then his lawyers got a new trial, and I had a detective-type person come to my house, knock on my door, and try to get me to say whatever negative things he thought he could get out of me about Karen and her mental health, because there was going to be a new trial, and they thought they could use that in a very negative way against her. So it's ongoing, the trial of the man who murdered her.
But so the other women, have you stayed in touch since with any of them?
I've stayed in touch with all of them. Hannah, the Jewish woman who loved Bob Dylan, is gone now. She died from MS. But she did, you know, her story is so wonderful in the film, because Hannah was the type of person who, she was bipolar, she had a really tragic life, but for her, there was something exciting and wonderful just around the corner. And so she always, her expectations were always that life would get better. And so she talks in the film about having never found a soulmate, and how if she didn't think that she would find a soulmate, she would end her life. She would walk into the river like Virginia Woolf with stones in her pockets. And she did eventually find a partner, and they married. I went to her wedding in Albuquerque. She married a Jewish man who had been taking care of his mother for years, and the mother died. And then he began to take care of Hannah. He carried her down the aisle because her MS by then was so bad. And they had a wonderful 2 or 3 years, and then now Hannah has passed.
I realize actually that we're talking about a film that probably most of our listeners haven't seen. So of course you are invited to come see that tonight. But there's, you know, these are broader issues that we are talking about, specifically about women and difficulties in a patriarchal society and mental health system, which is very much in evidence in your film. And there's, I'm sure, still a lot of that is still going on. But we have some callers. Good Soul is back. So go ahead. You are on the air.
Okay, can you hear me? I'm going to disconnect. Okay, sir?
Go ahead.
I'll need some help, Paul, with what he's saying, because I have a hard time understanding him.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, this is a very
the connection is bad.
Simple. You hear well. It seems like we're protecting the wards out there. Not well enough. I'm from a few. The connections are still a little garbled. I don't know if you can hear me.
Yeah, go ahead.
I didn't flush this phone.
It's a little clearer than it was.
All right. Well, if we have time, I can explain psychiatric elements of condition. I've learned from the pain of psychiatry myself. It's a bit of a conspiracy. I don't think anybody knows that, so I call it an auto conspiracy. It's something that people ignore because it's not really negligence. It's more like a misthought that just keeps getting perpetuated. So if we have some time, I can explain that.
Well, we don't have a
lot of people are hurt. Uh-huh. A lot of people are hurt.
Yes, yes. I mean, I can only speak for myself.
Oh, yes, go ahead. Your dialogue is well respected.
Thank you. I can only speak for myself, and I can speak for the women in my film because I know them well and because I've memorized their stories. When you edit something, you are very, very observant of what's going on. And each of the women have their own stories, and that's what I wanted to say about Hannah. You know, being a Jewish woman in America is how she puts herself forward. And each woman, her story is extremely different. It's painful, it's often humorous, but each is very different from the other. So
I think Good Soul,
we have to remember that.
I think Good Soul, you wanted to speak about your own experiences here?
Yeah, I would prefer that rather than if you were to tell me what the other women
I guess he left. Okay, so let's go to our next caller. Craig, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for this innovative program. My background, I grew up the son of a psychiatrist who worked in mental hospitals in California. And so when my parents divorced and we would visit him, we would go and live on site. And so I saw it growing up. And then when I went to college, I went to an experimental college that went to India for the year. And when I came back, they wanted to teach about rats and Skinner boxes, which made no sense. The reason why I say all of this is because in learning about the history of mental health in Oregon and understanding the history particularly of Fairview and how it was a working farm in the 20s and 30s where people had purpose in their lives. And how is it that we call what we have today progress in any stretch of the imagination?
Well, you're probably, Allie doesn't know about the Fairview, so that was obviously a hospital or whatever.
It was south of Salem. It was hundreds of acres. It was a farm that had gardens and animals and all kinds. I mean, it was a community. It was a community.
And you think from your research, you feel it helped people.
Don't you think that if someone has a sense of purpose?
No, I believe you. I'm just asking you specifically. I don't know anything about Fairview, so your sense is that it was a place that was a healing place, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I believe that to be true,
okay.
And I also was a housing specialist in the 90s when they were downsizing Fairview and Dumanish in Eastern Oregon, and taking them and then putting people into individual units, group home, you know, small decentralized group homes. And I never could understand why that model made more sense than the centralized model of creating community and purpose
Yeah, as long as they didn't sort of just warehouse people and leave them there forever. I don't know. I don't know anything about the history of Fairview. But that's an interesting point, the point of actually, and I know that was true for a number. I know St. Elizabeth's actually in Washington, which had a terrible, terrible reputation, I think deserved, but it also had a big farm. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, you could also think that perhaps some of those places, you know, maybe they exploited the labor. I don't know. This is a very complex issue, but I think that's just the point you're making, that, you know, giving people actually, you know, a connection to nature and a sense of community, just that point, I think, is, I feel that that's very, yeah, those are valuable things. Allie?
Well, and it's not to say that the abuses weren't rampant. They were, and they were horrific. And we need to come to grips and terms with that sometime as well. And I appreciate what your speaker is doing in that regard. But I think also that to keep the, you know, I think that all of these psychotropic drugs and all of this pharmacology has negative consequences every time. No,
we know that. We know. Yeah, we know that. I think any kind of positive support is important. But I don't know if you've ever been depressed.
Of course I have. If you're not,
it's a barrier. When it's very bad, it's a barrier that prevents anything from getting through. So that, you know, I mean, I like animals. I like everything that you mentioned. But I don't think when I was depressed, I could have. That it would have helped much, you know. I mean,
you don't.
I can only talk about my own depression. I can only speak about my own depression. That nothing penetrated it.
I hear that, but I'm also saying, I mean, think about how many poor people and even homeless people have pets when they can't afford themselves. But it's that connection of unconditional love that is so compelling to human beings.
Well, thank you for calling, Craig. We only have about 10 minutes left, and
it's gone fast.
Yeah, it does. It does go so fast.
It would be nice to speak a little bit about the other women also, you know.
Yeah. Well, again, people should really, we're talking about a film that's, you know, from 1994, of course, so it's not fresh in people's minds, and so, and the only chance people have to see it in Portland right now is, again, tonight at this Rethinking Psychiatry event at the Montevilla United Methodist Church. But yeah, I mean, the issues that Craig brings up are very compelling. It takes a long time to, you know, what really helps, what doesn't help, what's good for one person, what's good for, you know, it's hard to generalize things, I guess, is yeah. One thing.
Well, I think his experience is fascinating, to be the son of a psychiatrist and to spend time, you know, on site, as he said. I mean, that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. I hope he writes about it. We need to hear those stories also.
Okay. Well, again, thank you for calling, Craig. Talk a little bit more about some of the other women who appear in this Dialogues with Mad Women, because, again, you know, it'd be interesting if people have actually seen this from 1994. Yeah, talk about you know, a couple of the other women who appeared in the film.
Okay, well, two of the women were cutters, and I actually had not heard of that before, 25 years ago. So it was a surprise to me. One woman said she learned to cut from the stories of the saints, and she had been to Catholic school. And actually, when she told the story of her first Holy Communion and becoming the Bride of Christ, I knew the minute she said that in the interview, I knew that we had to illustrate that story, and we had to find a way to create a Bride of Christ. And so, you know, we had great fun looking for it. First I thought it should be a tree with a veil coming out of it, and then I cut up my old first wedding. I mean, I've had three husbands, so I cut up my first wedding dress and hung the veils in an empty tree without leaves. And then every time the wind blew, we filmed that. And that became the opening of the film. As she says, she became the Bride of Christ as a little girl at age 7. And we've gone from the Holy Communion of the children, which you see in the opening, to the tree with the veil from it. That became the opening. So, you know, the progress and the process of making a film goes on throughout the very first, from the first idea till the end of the film, and changes all the time.
Yeah, let me just as a footnote say that what you're saying is that you used a lot of footage from other places and also enactments of their own stories by the women involved to fill
exactly.
out in a really wonderful way. I thought that was really innovative. I hadn't seen that in another, you know, a documentary like that.
Well, we had no money, so we had to really improvise, and we had to figure out how to do things. And I knew some people who were working in the news business, you know, on television news. So that's where I got the turkeys in my story. And we just found and added as we went along. We decided exactly through the editing process what we needed to do to illustrate certain stories. I know I'm in touch with all of the women who are still living, and I pretty much know how their lives have gone. All of them upward, in an upward direction, and that's been good.
That's good. That's nice to hear, because one does wonder after seeing a film like that and after all they'd been through. But we got a couple other callers. We got David online. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay.
Hey there. This question, I'm one of the people that's organizing this, actually, with Rethinking. And another of our organizers is a therapist who composed this question, as will become evident as I ask it. So she noted that all the subjects of the film, it was apparent that they had trauma in their past, and that their madness, you know, seems directly related to that. Which, as she notes, flies in the face of this biopsychiatry notion that it's all due to a chemical imbalance. That's what we're told these days, right? That's the working.
Yeah, I was told that too. In some, yeah.
Yeah.
And so the question is
the connection to trauma that seemed to be to run through each of the women's stories.
Well, yes, it's a big part of a mental illness, poverty. Molestation, anything that, I mean, maybe we were suffering from PTSD. I mean, my new film is about PTSD, and why couldn't that lead to mental illness? It does certainly. It leads to suicide, and it leads to, you know, we haven't taken care of those young veterans coming back with PTSD, and maybe that was a whole subject that was never even thought about in connection to mental illness, but maybe that's what we're all suffering from.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference, I guess, between a mental breakdown and trauma that comes, that never goes away?
Right. The person who posed the question noted that she worked in a local community mental health agency, and she had clients for 20 years. They told her that she was the first person that they got to tell their stories to. So it would seem that if so much of this is due to trauma, that we're doing people a terrible disservice by the drug companies and the system that they run, that they finance. Telling people it's all a chemical imbalance and they better take these drugs. Sad.
Yeah, we know that, don't we? Yeah.
That for at least first hear their story before. Yeah, that's a.
Well, she was also curious if it. We know that now. Some of us, many people don't. But did it feel radical back then that this is so at odds with the dominant treatment modality? You know, this idea that it comes from trauma.
Well, don't you think talk therapy is always important? But my problem in the 50s was that talk therapy was with Freudians, and Freudians never gave you any feedback. you know, you could go in there into that room, and if you didn't talk, no one did. I mean, that was my experience with Freudian therapy, and it doesn't help at all. It's a good thing I had no money, and so I paid maybe a dollar or 50 cents for a session, because that was the worth of it. I really think that Freudian therapy ruined a lot of my life, ruined my relationship with my son, all the things that, you know, Freud said that we shouldn't do with our children. I tried to follow those rules. So what is talk therapy if you don't get any feedback?
Yeah, I've never done Freudian therapy, but I have found other forms of talk therapy to be helpful.
Yeah, I have too, and I'm very glad that you're coming with a message from a woman, because we haven't had any women callers this morning.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for calling, David.
I hope it goes well tonight, David, and I wish I was there for the Q&A.
Well, we do actually have Karen on the line. Speaking of a woman caller, let's give her a chance. Go ahead, Karen.
Good morning, and thank you for having the program. I wanted to say a couple of things. The first is that I avoided as much as I could the psychiatric system for many, many years by doing talk therapy with social workers, and I also was enormously helped eventually by Prozac for depression. It just transformed my life, but I had a lot of talk therapy as well. One of the things that most horrified me about what happened in my experience was the stigma, so that's why I went underground and avoided the psychiatric establishment until I could no longer do so, and I had to go for medication. That was 15 years after feeling suicidal pretty much every day. So I was just clinging by my fingertips, right? But what I really wanted to talk about was a book I read by a psychiatrist who was himself the son of Holocaust survivors, and he worked in Indian country. He did that in order to avoid being drafted. And he talks about a woman, one of his clients, who had a postpartum depression, and she stole someone else's baby because her baby had died. She took the other baby and she left the hospital with the baby for 3 days. Now, the biological parents were, of course, horrified and absolutely terrified, and finally she returned the baby. Now, when I read this story, I thought, oh, my God, you know, I can just imagine the lurid headlines, you know, evil woman steals baby in our culture. But what they did with her in Indian country was they invited her to come for Mother's Day, and she brought a kid with her as a kind of a gift, an offering, if you will. And I thought, oh, my gosh, the way that Indian country works to integrate people who've had an episode of disorder back into the culture is so different from what we do.
Well, I'm not sure how general that is, but that's a very interesting...
Right. It's a story from Carl Hammerschlag's book, Dancing Healers. If any of your listeners want to get it, Dancing Healers, it's a remarkable set of stories.
Okay, well, I'm sorry you called right at the very last, and we're flush out of time. I apologize,
all right.
Karen.
But one thing, diathesis stress model, Achilles heel plus stress, that's what I was taught in a graduate course in psychology. It's not either or, it's diathesis stress.
Okay.
In other words, we have an inborn Achilles heel, and if there's too great a stressor, it can crack us. That's my model. Okay, thank you so much. Have a good day.
And thank you. And these are all
things
that we'll hopefully be able to explore in the months to come. I know this is a difficult subject to tackle on the air. It's an interesting challenge, but a very important one. And so anyway, Allie Light, thank you for talking with us. Wish we had more time, but we got to move on to our next program.
Okay, it was a start, and pleasure was mine. So thank you.
And you have your new film, which we should at least mention, Any Wednesday, which you just mentioned, is that out in theaters now?
No, not yet. It's finished and it's making the festival rounds.
Okay, so that's something to look forward to. We could have talked a little bit about that, but that's all on my on my program page Wednesday Talk Radio. And if you have any suggestions or comments about this subject or others related, please go to Wednesday Talk Radio, click on my name, Paul Roland, highlighted in green, and then go to contact by email, click on that, and you can email me. So thank you so much, Ali Light, for talking with us this morning.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, that's this evening at the Montevilla Methodist Church on Southeast 80th Avenue. That's a Dialogue with
Women. I was riding in my car, screaming at the night, screaming at the dark, screaming at fright. I wasn't doing nothing, just driving about, screaming at the dark, letting it out. That's all I was doing, just letting it out.